Welcome to the Security Perimeter Podcast, an island of insanity, starring my dad, Athanasios Christoulos. This is an amazing podcast, really, the best. You're gonna love this, guaranteed, 100%. We are gonna make podcasting great again, promise. And now, my dad, Athanasios, aka Saki Christoulos.
So I know what you're saying, Why the hell is it taking me so long to put an episode up? Well, there's a few good reasons. First of all, the good news is that this episode is in English. Yay, Lamro, say yay.
Yay,
Walter, yay. So it's in English, so everybody all over the world can listen to it. And now, why is it taking me so long to do this? Well, first of all, it took me a while to line up some guests. I actually managed to record three episodes. You're going to listen to the first one right now. With Andrea Charon, defense and intelligence specialist in Canada, who's going to talk about Canada's new defense policy. So that was one problem, lining up the guests. Number two, well, you know, it is summer, and I am a professor, so I took my family to Puerto Vallarta. And so it was kind of Vallarta. So that was. And the third reason is, you know, a lot of the people that listen to this podcast are students. And, well, I know they're on vacation too, you know, gallivanting across the planet. And they're probably not going to listen to my podcast. But either way, I'm putting this one up. Anyways, on to Dr. Andrea Charon from Carleton University in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. The capital of Canada. Yeah, and for those of you who didn't know, it's also the place where the Justin lives. Justin Trudeau, not Justin Bieber. Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada.
Isn't that the same?
You didn't hear that. So, Andrea and I go back a few years. Dr. Charon is a professor, is an expert on defense policy and also an expert on Canadian intelligence, even though I shouldn't say that because she'll have to kill me. She's a professor at Carleton University in Ottawa. She's also a professor at Queen's University.
University of Manitoba.
Manitoba? I thought you were also at, aren't you at?
No, that Stephanie is. Queens. I'm University of Manitoba.
Aren't you at the Royal College as well?
No, that's where I did my PhD at the Royal Military. That's where I did my PhD. Yes, I'm with Jim Ferguson at the University of Manitoba.
And you also run the Center for the Study of Intelligence in Canada at Carleton, right?
Yeah, it's the new name. It's the Canadian Center for Security, Intelligence, and Defense Studies. So we do them all together.
Oh, so you added the defense part because...
Yeah, no, because that I think... That's the one of the biggest parts, and it was missing. So we added defense to it as well.
Okay. So Andrea's going to be talking about Canadian defense policy, like we said. Andrea, could you give us sort of like a thumbnail, kind of a resume? I'm saying it in Spanish because I'm forgetting my English. Sort of like a summary of Canada's defense situation, particularly in the context of, you know, the end of. Canada's participation in Afghanistan. I hear things aren't going so well, particularly with respect to the acquisition of a new surface combatant ship, which would be sort of like something between a frigate and a destroyer, from what I understand. There's also problems with the F-35 and the Super Hornet. And so, like, how are we doing defense-wise? I know Mexicans would be particularly interested in knowing about that.
Well, your timing is perfect because I think if we were talking just a few weeks ago, absolutely, we would say that the state of Canadian defense policy especially was in flux. We have a new government, a liberal government, taking over from 10 years of a conservative government. And generally, liberals and conservatives have very different perspectives when it comes to defense policy. Typically, liberals tend to spend as little as possible on defense, whereas the Conservative Party was known as sort of the cheerleaders of the military. But the Liberal government under Justin Trudeau has just released a brand new defense policy, and it is called Strong, Secure, and Engaged, and it is a jaw-dropper. It is the most unliberal-like defense policy Canada has seen. And when it was announced, many of us thought it's Christmas.
When was it announced?
It was released just about 2-3 weeks ago.
Oh, okay.
And it is quite a phenomenal doctrine. Now, on the one hand, much of the new announcements and new kit promised in it, because it's talking about a significant increase in the amount of defense spending. Many of those projects were sort of started under the Harper government and are sort of going forward. For example, the replacement of some of our aircraft, the jet fighter, for example, will we do F-35 or not? Many of our naval procurement. Still, this new defense policy has promised spending on people, on kit, even changing the way it accounts for the procurement of kit.
What's kit?
Kit. So things like new planes, new ships, new boots, new equipment. So what's really interesting is that the new foreign policy was announced on June 6th, and then the defense policy was announced on June 7th, followed very quickly by a new security policy. And really, to understand the defense policy, you need to look at Minister Freeland, who is our Minister of Foreign Affairs, look at her foreign policy statement. It is a jaw-dropper.
Could you tell us what it is?
Yeah. So basically, Canada and the United States have this very, very special relationship.
Right.
And the pinnacle of this is something called NORAD, the North American Aerospace Defense Command, this binational command that commits Canada and the U.S. to jointly defending both countries.
Right.
But this speech by Minister Freeland suggested that perhaps Canada cannot depend on the U.S. as it did in the past. And without using Trump's name, suggested that Canada had been very fortunate in the past to always have the U.S. As our biggest supporter, but perhaps that needs to be rethought going forward. Now, she was quick to say the U.S. remains an important ally and friend, but then you see the defense policy announced on the next day, and what you see is a particular focus on the defense of Canada. Now, that's always been the case. Every defense policy has said we defend Canada first, then we defend North America, and then we help out where we can in the rest of the world. But usually that first one, the defense of Canada, is we defend Canada, but actually we always do it with U.S., so we can afford to cut corners.
Right.
This time, this defense policy actually spends a lot of time and attention on the defense of Canada. How do we do it? Do we have enough personnel? Do we have enough staff? Do we need to rethink things like command and control and how we communicate with each other to make sure that we can defend Canada and then, by extension, defend North America and assist in the world?
So what does it say in terms of, I mean, okay, that's the policy change, right? That there's a focus on that Canada's going to be responsible for its own territoriality and defense and sovereignty.
That's always been the case. However, well, some would say we paid lip service to that because we have a very small military. So, for instance, in this new defense policy, they propose to increase defense spending from $18.9 billion in 2016 to 2017 to $32 billion by 2026.
Wow.
And they're also proposing an increase of our regular forces to 71,500. right now we have about, on the books, 63,000, but really I would say probably about 60,000 you would consider sort of combat capable. They propose 71,500 regular personnel, but then we have approximately 25,000 reserves. And within the reserve category, there's two types. There's type A and type B. Type A are the, you can, they're full time, you can deploy them just like you would regular forces. Part B are sort of your, they will assist on weekends. They can be trained to go on missions, but they're on a part-time status as opposed to a full-time status.
Okay. So if you put, type A and the active together, that would mean about 80, I guess, under the new plan?
Well, in according to this plan, by 2026, we are looking at approximately 100,000. And what's more, there's a promise to have 25% women in the regular forces. So that would require an increase of 1% per year.
So that's across all three services, right?
That's across Army, Navy, and Air Force. And I don't know if your listeners will notice, but right now in the London, UK, it's the Canadians doing the change of the guard at Buckingham Palace, and it's a Canadian combat officer who's in charge. The UK has never had a woman in that position. So that's unique to Canada.
So what else does the review say in terms of, I mean, other than numbers?
So in addition to increasing the numbers of personnel, the first chapter is dedicated to paying more attention to personnel issues, things like making sure that our veterans are better taken care of, making sure that families are supported, that personnel are better supported, and even thinking about changing the work conditions, so maybe considering full-time and part-time positions to allow for that work-life balance. So it's a real paradigm shift in terms of thinking about the people and personnel in the Canadian Armed Forces. But then there's also the promises of new equipment, such as eventually a replacement for our CF-18s, our fighter jets. It does not mention a specific fighter jet. Mm-hmm. The debate has been, will we or won't we buy the F-35s? Mm-hmm. There has been an announcement that we would need an interim solution in a Super Hornet. But that is now, interestingly, not mentioned in the defense policy because there's been so much pushback by especially retired former military saying it would be inadvisable to have potentially three air platforms at one go. We're too small of Canadian forces to manage that, train for that, and keep them maintained.
Yeah, I mean, my view on the Super Hornet, well, I mean, you're kind of spending money that you know is going to eventually be money not particularly well spent. So why don't you wait and look to buy the actual platform that you're looking to replace the F-18? Is the F-35 still in the game, so to speak? I mean, the news about the F-35 is all bad. It's almost daily now.
Well, I think that's why, you know, in some ways the Trudeau government is thankful that there wasn't a precipitous decision made by the Harper government about what to buy. So in many ways, Canada's starting from scratch again to consider what will be the replacement aircraft. The problem is that these CF-18s are very, very old.
Yeah.
They're very well used, and the metal fatigue issue on these jets, it needs to be considered, because especially our jets are not only doing service overseas and, for example, Iraq and Syria, but also do regular sorties and surveillance of the Arctic, and that makes for very harsh conditions on the airframe.
Right, and they also are very active in NORAD, presumably.
Yeah, that's part of the NORAD mission.
So yeah.
Regular surveillance missions.
So are you willing to go on a limb and guess what Canada might do about the replacement fighter?
Well, this has always been the problem with Canada and procurement. We tend to form lots of committees, think about it, make a decision, and invariably a new government comes into place and kills the decision and starts all over again. And depending on how long Mr. Trudeau is prime minister, this could be the scenario we face. On the one hand, it is quite clear we absolutely need a replacement. On the other hand, their considerations are we compatible with the U.S. because of the NORAD mission, right? That is absolutely the first consideration. We must be able to plug and play with the U.S. Mm-hmm. Second, we must be able to plug and play with the majority of our NATO members. But we also have some important allies that aren't part of NATO, like Australia, like New Zealand, growing interest in what Japan does, et cetera, et cetera. So all of these considerations have to be taken into place. And normally with a Liberal government, we would say we'll go with the cheapest option. Mm-hmm. This defense policy suggests that maybe this Liberal government would be willing to put in more money into a fighter replacement. The final sort of Canadiana trivia part we have to consider is the made in Canada component of this. And we have Bombardier based in Montreal, whom we like to protect. That's not to say that Bombardier would produce the airframe, but if we're in competition with, let's say, another company that would make the fighter jet, but they're going to take business away from Bombardier via some other airframe, then all of those political decisions come into the mix as well.
All right, let me put the question another way, and I think you're just trying to avoid answering it. What would the Royal Air Force, the Royal Canadian Air Force, like to see as a new fighter?
Well, that's a tough question, because each airframe are better at certain purposes. So according to this new defense policy, defense of Canada is most important. So we want something that's fast, not necessarily stealth, because we want people to see us coming and to have considerable potential firepower, but have to be able to go long distances.
Okay.
If going
so
to
the
be
the F-35 doesn't do much of any of that.
Get that. But if you want to be in a plug-and-play situation with NATO and U.S. coalitions overseas, then yeah, F-35 would work. So this is the conundrum. We can't afford more than one airframe.
Yeah.
Because we also need things like the Aurora surveillance. We need Twin Otters to do search and rescue and, you know, to be the lift. We have the C-140s to do strategic lift. We can't just spend money willy-nilly. So we have to be very careful about what frame we pick.
But you must have a favorite. I'm not going to ask you what it is, but come on, deep down inside, Andrea, you must have a favorite that you'd like to see.
You know what? Because of Arctic is my focus, yeah. I something that potentially could be able to work well in the Arctic long term. But guess what? No fighter jet can do that well because of the metal fatigue. I guess we would ideally get what the Russians get.
Okay, what about the Navy? What's the idea there? I mean, the frigates are getting old, so there's a plan for a new surface combat vessel, which is like a mix between a frigate and a destroyer in terms of capability, size, and so forth. Is that going to move forward?
Yep. According to the defense policy, we also have steel has already been cut on the promised now only 6 to 8 Arctic offshore patrol vessels to be able to do coastal patrol. And what's very interesting about those vessels is that they've been designed so that multiple agencies can have kit and caboodle on top to assist with police, with customs, border services, agency activity, Transportation Canada activity. So it's going to be a multi-purpose vessel, but it will be piloted by the Navy.
But that's not the replacement for the frigates. That's just the Arctic. That's just the Arctic patrol vessel, right?
It's important to put the offshore in there because it'll spend most of its time on the coastlines, the east and west coastline, because it's not an icebreaker. It's only ice strengthened, right. So it can still only go in the Arctic in the summer months and shoulder months.
Now, it has combat capability, right?
Well, it will have a gun on it, and a gun that could do some serious damage, but no, this is not expected to be able to do anti-submarine warfare.
All right, so what about the other, the replacement for the frigates? I forget what they're called, but...
We have maritime coastal vehicles, which are getting refit, and then we have our frigates, which are also getting refit and a promise of replacement. The defense policy is really quite an amazing...
I have to download it. I didn't realize that. I mean, you mentioned three things. You mentioned first a change in foreign policy, then a change in security policy, and then a change in defense policy, which is...
Yeah.
While you're trying to hunt that down, can I ask you another question?
Okay. I have it here. So,
yeah.
For the Canadian Navy, recapitalized the surface fleet through the investment of 15 Canadian surface combatants and 2 joint support ships.
Okay.
Acquire the 5 to 6 Arctic offshore patrol vessels. We are also going to modernize our 4 Victoria class submarines, which I'm told are very, very stealthy.
But they need
some upgrades. And a big focus on this defense policy on more intelligence, more domain awareness, more communication, oversight of command and control. They've really gone quite deep in the weeds.
Okay, so this change or this shift in policy or this dramatic increase in capabilities is in order to put Canada first, so to speak, right? In order to actually do something concrete in terms of the defense of Canada's territoriality and sovereignty and so forth. And you set it up sort of like as a response to many of Trump's comments. In a way, though, this... is an acknowledgement that Canada has to do something. Or when Trump says that, you know, the allies need to up their percentage and maybe get as close to 2 as possible, isn't this what Canada's trying to do with this? To get it spending up, to sort of kind of acknowledge that Trump may have a point in the fact that the allies seem to be, to some extent, anyways, free riding.
Well. Yes and no, because on the one hand,
to defend Trump here.
No.
I mean, but spending is quite low in quite a few NATO countries.
It is. We're not reaching that magic 2%, nor will we with the new plan.
Mm-hmm.
So that 2% of GDP, we are still not going to reach. What Canada has always argued is that you get with us quality, not quantity. Now, most U.S. Right. governments in the past have said, yeah, we like the quality. We understand you have only 36 million people. You can't spend lots on defense. That's not what the Canadian people or government want to do. But what you give us, we'll accept. With Trump was a realization that maybe he is different from the other U.S. governments and he won't accept the quality that we can bring. And so maybe we do need to think about what it means to defend Canada. So in that respect, I think Trump has actually been good for Canada to sit down and really think, what is it we need?
Mm-hmm.
Trump will take this absolutely as a victory.
Yes.
For Canada, our focus and main concern vis-a-vis Trump will always be the NAFTA agreement.
Okay. So,
and the hope is that he won't trade off, you didn't spend enough on defense, we'll bite you on NAFTA, which in the past, U.S. governments didn't do that. They tended to compartmentalize issues, right. And you wouldn't be penalized in one area for another. But this, with this Trump, all bets are off.
So you think this is partly... sort of an acknowledgement that what Merkel said a couple of weeks ago about that we have to look at ways to help ourselves. It's partly that, it's partly the 2% comments, and it's also partly NAFTA.
And it's also the fourth and probably most important part is Canadians love their military and been calling for a long time now to better support them.
Okay.
And I think this government has realized that Canadians feel strongly enough about this that this could be an election issue. And if they do what past Liberal governments do, which is to get out of debt problems by cutting in the defense area, this could be it for them. And it's in the areas where people what I call the connective tissue of the Canadian Armed Forces, the areas that people generally, we don't really care, we don't see it, so whatever.
Yeah.
But if you don't have those connective tissues, if you don't have strong command and control, if you don't have your correct satellite link-ups, if you don't have enough intelligence and capability to evaluate that intelligence, things fall off the rails very quickly. And there is a lot of emphasis on the need for new intelligence officers, increased satellite coverage, et cetera, which is usually that's left out of defense policies.
Okay. Well, tell us about the Arctic a little bit. You mentioned the Arctic Offshore Patrol Vessel, and that's a central aspect of Canada's new... Well, it's not that new, because, I mean, the announcement came under Harper that Canada was going to do this. So what's going on? Why the concern with the Arctic? I mean, we've talked about it before in the podcast with other people, but I want to take your take. I want your take on it. How do you see the situation with Mr. Putin and his, his pushing wherever he seems to be able to push? Do you really see a threat there?
No.
Okay.
No, and I think I'm an outlier in this position. Yeah. I think for successive prime ministers have used the Arctic as a bit of a political football. Because in certainly the Cold War, it was the avenue for attack for the Soviet Union. We always had to make sure we understood what was happening in there without really giving much thought to the people that lived there. That was sort of the afterthought. Mm-hmm. And so we did things like put in successive radar lines further north so that we could detect any air-breathing threats coming at Canada and ultimately the U.S.
Okay.
NORAD is still in place. The North Warning System is in need of upgrading. It's a series of long and short radar lines, and the short radar lines, their end of life is coming up, and they need to be upgraded. And the thought is maybe we also need to move them further north, and maybe we need to give them more capability so they're not just detecting air-breathing threats. Mm-hmm. Problem with the warning system is they were designed to detect bear bombers, which fly at a certain altitude and a certain speed.
Right.
But now with a new threat of cruise missiles and drones, they're lower flying and also variable speeds. And our North Warning systems can't detect those. So there's a whole rethink about what we need. Now, we will always... especially via NORAD, need to understand what's coming at us. Mm-hmm. But the real concerns in the Arctic are not Russian bear bombers. They're things like not having sustainable communities, not having healthy communities. Around the Arctic, the health indicators for people of the North are dismal. And Russia and Canada are the worst. And Russia is arguably less well off than many in Canada's north. And so while attention is often turned to the potential for a military threat and we need to prepare for that, what then is forgotten about is what is really core to sovereignty in Canada, which is healthy, sustainable communities that can survive for generations and generations and see a future there. So I was going to say that Russia, of course, has half of the Arctic Ocean frontage. They have, of the 4 million people that live in the Arctic, Russia has 2 million people. Russia has put all of their GDP eggs into the Arctic basket. They're really hoping the Arctic can get them out of the economic malaise they are in.
It's the resources, right? Apparently, but they're not proven resources, are they?
Well, there's certainly more proven resources than Canada has. Canada has less oil in the Arctic than many think. And now that we have a moratorium on oil exploration, it's a non-issue.
Right.
But what really benefits Russia is its geography. It has three oceans the size of the Mississippi that go deep, deep, deep into Russia. And it has this northern route through the Arctic, similar to our Northwest Passage. So it could be the transportation link between Asia and Europe if people were to use the Russian northern route. So they're really hoping that between that geography, the fact that they have some big shipping ports like Murmansk, and the amount of resources they have in the Arctic, this could be their economic driver.
All right, but this is within Russian, recognized Russian sovereign territory, is that right?
That's right.
Okay, so why would Canada have a problem with that? Or why would some Canadians have a problem with that?
Well, I'm not quite sure, because I think, you know, if Russia is better off economically speaking, its people are better off economically speaking, then you tend to do less things like trying to divert everybody's attention to why, you know, you don't have proper services and education and university funding and things like that by dabbling in geopolitical conflicts elsewhere.
Okay, but Andrea, isn't there a fight brewing over sovereign rights in the Arctic that's bringing Canada and the Russians sort of to loggerheads on this?
So this is a common meme that we hear, and what you refer is this is the extended continental shelf.
Yeah.
Which all countries which border an ocean have the right to collect evidence and say, listen, our extended continental shelf, which is pretend you're standing on the shoreline and you start walking into the ocean and your feet are still touching the shore, the land underneath you. Right. If you could, in theory, walk beyond 200 nautical miles and still your feet are on ground, then you can claim just that ocean floor and the resources directly on top of it and underneath it, and that is it. Okay. But there's a UN process, and so far, I have to say, Russia has followed it and even ceded territory in some cases with the overlapping claims it's had with Norway.
Okay, so it sounds as though there really isn't a problem.
No, and the military, what we need to do is we're watching Russia because it is doing some, you know, it invaded Ukraine and took back Crimea. It's helping the Assad regime in Syria. I mean, it's doing some despicable things. Mm-hmm. But when it's come to the Arctic and its participation on things like the Arctic Council, it has been supporting the mission of it on environmental protection and sustainable development. It's almost as if there are two Russias.
Yeah.
There's the Russia in Eastern Europe and the Middle East, and then there's the Russia in the Arctic. And for the Arctic to work well, it needs to be a place where rules are followed, and Russia, by and large, tends to follow them. Yes, they buzz us, but they know better than anybody where those limits are, and that's why we've always had NORAD and we'll always have NORAD. Well, the reason the Arctic offshore patrol vessels come in is because we are expecting some more traffic in the Arctic. So, for example, for the second time, the Crystal Serenity, the largest cruise ship yet to transit the Northwest Passage, is coming through in August. Mm-hmm. And we need to be able to, for example, transport customs officials to check everybody on board. We need to make sure that vessels are following the new mandatory polar code and aren't polluting. Because, again, we're a very, very small government and it's very difficult to operate in the Arctic, we need lots of agencies to work together. So it's just not feasible, for example, Transport Canada and Customs, et cetera, all to buy their own ice-strengthened hulls. It makes much more sense if we have one and get the Navy to pilot it, and then we put it, plug and play what we need on board as situations dictate. So it's for the security aspect, not for the defense state-on-state aggression.
Recently, there has been another very serious development which threatens the maintenance of the peace in Southwest Asia. massive Soviet military forces have invaded the small, non-aligned, sovereign nation of Afghanistan, which had hitherto not been an occupied satellite of the Soviet Union. 50,000 heavily armed Soviet troops have crossed the border and are now dispersed throughout Afghanistan, attempting to conquer the fiercely independent Muslim people of that country. The Soviets claim falsely that they were invited into Afghanistan to help protect that country from some unnamed outside threat. But the president, who had been the leader of Afghanistan before the Soviet invasion, was assassinated, along with several members of his family, after the Soviets gained control of the capital city of Kabul. Only several days later was a new puppet leader even brought into Afghanistan by the Soviets. This invasion is an extremely serious threat to peace because of a threat of further Soviet expansion into neighboring countries in Southwest Asia, and also because such an aggressive military policy is unsettling to other peoples throughout the world. This is a callous violation of international law and the United Nations Charter. It is a deliberate effort of a powerful atheistic government to subjugate an independent Islamic people. We must recognize the strategic importance of Afghanistan to stability and peace. A Soviet-occupied Afghanistan threatens both Iran and Pakistan and is a stepping stone to possible control over much of the world's oil supplies. The United States wants all nations in the region to be free and to be independent. If the Soviets are encouraged in this invasion by eventual success, and if they maintain their dominance over Afghanistan and then extend their control to adjacent countries, the stable, strategic, and peaceful balance of the entire world will be changed. This would threaten the security of all nations, including, of course, the United States, our allies, and our friends.
Mexico has observers in NORAD and NORTHCOM. So Mexico is starting to see its security interests in continental terms, in North American terms. So how do you see NORAD moving forward, and what do you see Mexico's role or potential role in the alliance?
Well, that's a great question. NORAD has always been the North American Aerospace Defense Command, and it jointly defends Canada, continental U.S., and Alaska from, especially in the past, air-breathing threats. In 2006, it was signed in perpetuity, and they added on a new mission to do maritime warning as well. Now, NORAD is actually made up of three different commands. There's the U.S. Northern Command, there's NORAD, and then there's the Canadian Joint Operations Command. But within U.S. NORTHCOM, you have Mexican representation. And that's because the security and defense of continental U.S. also depends on what happens in Mexico. And the thinking is that if North American defense is really going to happen, it really should include Mexico as part of the wider NORAD mission. Mm-hmm. Now, there's reluctance on the part of Canada, and there's reluctance on the part of Mexico to join NORAD. Canada wants to jealously guard our relationship that we have with the U.S., but also Mexico and Canada have different issues vis-a-vis the U.S., but going forward, especially if, for example, NORAD starts taking on cyber missions, which cross national boundaries and can do untold havoc, we could see eventually the inclusion of Mexico as part of NORAD for a truly continental defense of North America.
Yeah, I think the Mexicans, honestly, are less resistant to it now than they were, let's say, 10 years ago. And who knows? It might happen. Some people out there have suggested that maybe even Mexico should consider joining NATO, especially if...
That was David Hyland's argument, that Mexico should be part of NATO. I think where it's starting to happen is especially on drug interdiction. And you're seeing the U.S. Coast Guard, the Canadian military, and the U.S., the Mexico Navy working together to try and cut off the drugs coming up, especially from South America. And NORAD is also starting to take on a slightly different role from just a defense role because of the function of maritime warning and the fact that maritime threats come in all sorts of shapes and sizes, and they're usually of the security variant as opposed to the defense variant. And because U.S. NORTHCOM also has homeland security connected to it and 60 other civilian agencies, I could see a sort of a security NORAD with Canada, the U.S., and Mexico, similar to the border initiative.
Yeah.
Remember, what was your...
The smart border agreement stuff, yeah.
The smart border restarting again with Mexico, U.S., and Canada, being as we are seeing some common security issues with the influx of migrants and drugs coming up via South America.
One last thing on this. Ship Rider, could you describe that a little bit? Because it is part of the whole North America, not necessarily, it's part of NORTHCOM, right? Is it still active? Would you know?
Yeah, no, Ship Rider still happens. What that is Canada. Yeah, sure. So Canada and the U.S. share these Great Lakes. And you don't see the border crossing when you're in the Great Lakes. You don't know if you're on the U.S. or the Canadian side. And if you were a drug runner, or you were peddling illegal goods, all you needed to do was get a fast boat to go into the other jurisdiction. And of course, the U.S. Police couldn't cross into Canada and arrest people. And likewise, the Canadian police couldn't go into the U.S. jurisdiction. So what they've done now is called Ship Rider, where on one ship, they will have U.S. and Canadian authorities. So depending on where they are, they just say, you know, Joe from Canada, it's your turn, or Mary from the U.S., it's your turn. And eventually they want to train individuals to be able to have officer powers for both countries in one person.
Sort of like IBETS, the Integrated Border Enforcement Teams, but for the Great Lakes. Is that a fair comparison?
That's basically what it came out of. So this is an offshoot of IBETS particular to the Great Lakes.
The Integrated Border Enforcement Teams apparently are jointly patrolled areas along the border. Yes. I think there's about 17 of them where local authorities from both sides of the border do operations and sort of like the Ship Rider program. You could actually see, you know, New York State troopers on the Canadian side, and you can actually see RCMP or Sûreté du Québec on the Vermont side, and it's not considered a big issue anymore.
No, and there are hundreds of agreements that allow for this cross pollination of agencies and working together. Yeah. So, I suspect this will continue as long as we have this security community that is Canada, U.S.,
and
North America.
Let's hope Mexico eventually joins in.
Eventually, that would make sense.
As long as the
Canadians
don't get too jealous about Mexican participation.
Yeah, well, that's always been our big fear, because we don't want our border to look like the Mexican border. I'm sure the Mexicans don't want their border to look like the Mexican border, but U.S. tends to go to the lowest common denominator. And what's good for one must be good for the other. But for Canada, that would be our security has always been defined as economic security. If you look at our customs heraldic badge, it's a porticulus, which is a fence, which often guards treasure. And the questions you get at the border in Canada, you're met by a customs officer, and the question used to be, where were you and what did you buy? Whereas when you went on to the U.S. side, you're dealing with what was immigration long ago, and they would ask you, who are you and where are you going? Because Canada and the U.S. do see the border differently. And so they've had to sort of, Canada has had to bend to accept the U.S. caveats. It's not that people aren't a concern in Canada, but economic security was always our primary concern.
All right. The last thing that I want to bother you with, because I know you got a lot of parties to go to, it's Canada Day week. I'm sure you're planning a barbecue, aren't you? Or
of course,
what's the
that's
plan?
The Canadian to do. Yes, absolutely. A barbecue and watch the fireworks. So, huge plans.
Okay, last topic that I want to talk to you about. NATO. How do all these changes fit into Canada's participation in NATO the other Russia that you mentioned a few moments ago?
For the other Russia, we have committed Canadian Armed Forces to what we call Operation Reassurance. To send Canadian Armed Forces to the Eastern Europe. We were part of the Baltic policing program of NATO just to show Russia that we're in the area. But right now we have forces now in Latvia in a Canadian-led contingent. And the big concern so far has been the cyber attacks and also the misinformation that Russia likes to sow among local populations about what are the intentions of the Canadian Armed Forces there. So things like, you know, watch out for your girls and women because the Canadian Armed Forces are known to be rapists. And so it's
are they specifically singling out Canada and saying, Canadian troops?
Yeah, so we had a former Canadian Armed Forces officer who had raped and killed some women in Canada. And so they're suggesting that everybody going to Latvia is similar to this individual. And so it's really changed, you know, the type of mission that the Canadians can do in Latvia because they are already conscious of that active communication, misinformation that's being spread to sow doubt and misapprehension among the Latvian population.
How big is the deployment?
That I'd have to check. I want to say 300, we should double up that.
And it's a Canadian-led brigade, from what I understand, right?
Yes. So there will be other countries that are contributing, not just Canada, but it's a Canadian-led.
The security policy change. You said that there was a foreign policy change, a security policy change, and then a defense policy. Could I ask you quickly, how has the foreign policy part changed, and how has that impacted the security policy? I mean, Canada still sees its main security issues as being NATO, NORAD, North America. That hasn't changed. Is that right?
See, most of it is to do with clarification on laws that came in place under Harper to deal with terrorism and counterterrorism. Mm-hmm. So it's things like having an parliamentary oversight of our security intelligence organizations and the like. So it wasn't as it's a huge report. It's a couple of hundred pages that we have to go through. But obviously the three taken together is a stamp by the new government that wants to rethink how we defend and securitize Canada. That being said, you know, his term is for 4 years until there's a potential re-election. So all of this could come for naught if he is not reelected and somebody else comes in. And this is a lot of money we're talking about at a time when it's like trying to change the tire on a car while it's still running. Yeah. And with a public service that has been the Harper government cut a lot of public service positions. Do we actually have the skills and the people in place to put all these plans into action. That's going to be what I'm going to watch for.